Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The killing of journalist Tsai Win-ung in Myanmar has been condemned by the UN's Cultural, Scientific and Educational Organization, UNESCO. It said that the reporter, who was also known as A Sai K, died on the 25th of December while covering the plight of refugees in the southeastern state of Cayenne for the Federal News Journal. He was fatally shot in an artillery attack by the Myanmar Armed Forces, UNESCO said, citing reports, making him the second journalist to be killed in Myanmar last month. Appealing for a full investigation into Mr. Ung's death, UNESCO head Audrey Azoulay said that media workers like Tsai Win-ung risked their lives to keep the public informed and that they deserve to be protected in line with international humanitarian law. In Afghanistan, harsh winter conditions are aggravating the severe crisis facing millions across the country. That's the warning from UN Aid Coordination Office OCHA, which said that heavy snowfall and rain have already disrupted flights to and from Kabul Airport, just as forecasts have indicated further snow in coming days. The humanitarian situation in Afghanistan was bad even before the Taliban takeover last August, but it has been made worse by the subsequent suspension of aid to the country and the freezing of Afghanistan's assets by many countries and international organizations. According to UN humanitarians, more than 24 million Afghans are expected to need assistance this year, and more than 9 in 10 of them are likely to be acutely food insecure by March. To northwest Syria now, where two children have been killed and 5 others injured in violence linked to the long-running conflict since the start of the year. The news, reported on Tuesday by UN Children's Fund UNICEF, came as it condemned an attack on a water station in Arshani village outside Idlib, which cut the supply to more than 240,000 people. Children and services catering to them must never come under attack, UNICEF said in a statement. In an earlier declaration, the UN's Deputy Regional Humanitarian Coordinator for Syria, Mark Cutts, tweeted that in northwestern Syria, airstrikes were continuing and that more civilians were being killed in Idlib. The northwestern region is the last opposition-held enclave in Syria and home to some 2.8 million people who've been displaced by nearly 11 years of war. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Good afternoon. I'm your host, Mike Cadell. In the second hour, TUC Radio, here's a preview.
Why would only a totalitarian government have to rely on propaganda to convince its citizens of particular policies, although these citizens have no power to affect these policies? Propaganda is much more needed in democratic societies where citizens have the right, and in theory, the power, to change the policies of their governments.
Corporations and Propaganda by Alex Carey. On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
Again, that's in the second hour, following Alex Smith's Radio Eco Shock. And here's today's headlines from Democracy Now!, provided by Amy Goodman.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Chicago's canceled school for today after the Chicago Teachers Union voted Tuesday night for classes to go remote due to the surge in COVID-19 cases. In a statement, the union said, quote, "This decision was made with a heavy heart and a singular focus on student and community safety," unquote. This comes as schools across the nation are grappling with how to keep students and teachers safe as the Omicron variant rapidly spreads. In suburban Chicago, one district had to close 5 schools Tuesday because more than 500 teachers and staff were out sick. In Florida, thousands of teachers have called out sick as COVID cases skyrocket in the Miami area. On Tuesday, President Biden reiterated his support for keeping schools open during the COVID surge.
We know that our kids can be safe when in school, by the way. That's why I believe schools should remain open.
The Centers for Disease Control has decided to largely stick with its new COVID isolation guidance, saying people with asymptomatic infections can stop isolating after 5 days, down from 10 days. On Tuesday, the CDC said infected people could take a rapid test before ending isolation, but the agency is not mandating it. Meanwhile, new government data shows 113,000 people are now hospitalized with COVID-19, higher than during the Delta surge over the summer. In international news, officials in India have announced a weekend curfew in New Delhi as COVID cases reach a nine-month high. Between Friday night and Monday morning, all non-essential businesses will be closed in India's largest city. Meanwhile, Hong Kong's banning flights from the United States, Britain, and six other countries for the next 2 weeks. The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection is asking Sean Hannity, the Fox News host and close confidant of Donald Trump, to voluntarily cooperate with its investigation. In a letter, the committee said it believed Hannity had, quote, advanced knowledge regarding President Trump's and his legal team's planning for January 6th, unquote. On Tuesday, the committee released a number of text messages sent by Hannity to White House officials before and after the insurrection. On January 5th, Hannity wrote to White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows saying he was, quote, very worried about the next 48 hours, unquote. Shortly after the news broke about Hannity's text messages, Donald Trump canceled a news conference he scheduled for Thursday on the first anniversary of the insurrection. The January 6th committee has also indicated it hopes to speak with former Vice President Mike Pence as part of its investigation. Meanwhile, Trump is facing two new federal lawsuits for his role in encouraging the deadly riot. One suit was filed by a U.S. Capitol Police officer, the other by two members of the D.C. Metropolitan Police. In other related news, former Trump trade advisor Peter Navarro was interviewed on MSNBC Tuesday by Ari Melber. Navarro outlined his support last year for what he called the Green Bay Sweep, the plan to overturn the election results in six states.
Yes. We had over 100 congressmen and senators on Capitol Hill ready to implement the sweep. The sweep was simply that. We were going to challenge the results of the election in the six battleground states. They were Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Wisconsin, Nevada.
Do you realize you are describing a coup?
No, I totally reject many of your premises there.
A new investigation by The Washington Post and ProPublica has found Facebook played a key role in spreading false information about the 2020 election in the lead-up to the January 6th insurrection. The news outlets report at least 650,000 messages were posted on Facebook attacking the legitimacy of Joe Biden's victory prior to the insurrection, with many calling for political violence, including executions. On Capitol Hill, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer vowed Tuesday to proceed with a vote to change the filibuster rule to prevent Republicans from blocking new voting rights legislation. Schumer spoke on the floor of the Senate.
There is no better way to heal the damage of January 6th than to act so that our constitutional order is preserved for the future. If we do not act to protect our elections, the horrors of January 6th will risk becoming not the exception, but the norm.
Great.
The stakes could not be higher, so we are going to move forward.
It remains unclear, however, if the Democratic leadership has the votes needed. On Tuesday, Democratic Senator Joe Manchin voiced skepticism about changing the filibuster rules.
Let me just say that to being open to a rules change that would create a nuclear option, it's a very, very difficult. So it's a heavy lift.
In other voting rights news, the prominent radio host Joe Madison is in his 59th day of a hunger strike. He's vowed not to eat any solid food until Congress passes the Freedom to Vote Act or the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. The Canadian government's agreed to give over $15 billion to Indigenous children harmed by Canada's child welfare system, including tens of thousands of children who were taken from their families and put into the system. In addition, Canada has pledged to spend another $15 billion to reform the nation's child welfare system. First Nations Manitoba Regional Chief Cindy Woodhouse praised the unprecedented settlement.
We have a long way to go to address the poverty in our nations, and no amount of money will ever be the right amount, nor will it bring back a childhood lost. But today is about acknowledgement, about being seen and heard.
U.S. authorities have arrested a retired Colombian military commando for his involvement, allegedly, in last year's assassination of Haiti's President Jovenel Moïse. The man, Mario Antonio Palacios, was arrested in Panama while traveling to Colombia after being deported from Jamaica. He was then flown to Miami, where he appeared in court Tuesday. Palacios is accused of being part of the mercenary team hired to carry out the president's execution. It's still unknown who hired the mercenaries to attack Moïse's home. A Palestinian prisoner has ended a 141-day hunger strike after Israel agreed to release him next month. Hisham Abu Hawash began the hunger strike to protest what's known as administrative detention, where Israel holds Palestinians without charge or trial. His brother, Imad, celebrated the news Tuesday.
I can't describe how happy I am. I even can't express how happy I am. Today we are happy for Hisham, who won over this oppressive criminal state, Israel. Today Hisham achieved victory for all the prisoners, martyrs, all the Palestinians, even for those who are in the diaspora.
In more news from the region, the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem reports 2021 was the deadliest year for Palestinians since 2014, as Israeli forces killed 313 Palestinians last year, including 71 minors. In addition, Israel demolished nearly 300 residential structures in the occupied West Bank and occupied East Jerusalem last year, the highest number since 2016. This left nearly 900 Palestinians homeless. The demolitions are continuing. On Tuesday, Israeli forces demolished part of a health care center, which serves 20,000 people in occupied East Jerusalem. In Sudan, security forces fired live ammunition, stun grenades, and tear gas at protesters on Tuesday as demonstrations continue across Sudan demanding civilian rule. Security forces blocked roads leading to the Republican Palace in central Khartoum. 70 protesters were reportedly injured across Sudan Tuesday. The protests came 2 days after the Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok resigned.
Today, after Hamdok's resignation, the people are confirming the need for Sudanese men and women of all parties to move forward despite the repression. They are facing off against the state, as you can hear from the sound of the bombs being fired at those on the front lines who are facing this abuse for the sake of a free, peaceful, and just state.
The president of Kazakhstan has declared a two-week state of emergency in parts of the country and has dismissed his entire cabinet following days of protest over rising fuel prices. Earlier today, protesters in the oil-rich nation stormed the mayor's office in Almaty, Kazakhstan's largest city, and attempted to break into the presidential residence. Here in New York, the district attorney of Albany County has announced he's dropping a sex crime charge against disgraced former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. In October, the county sheriff filed a criminal complaint against Cuomo, charging him with forcible touching for allegedly groping his former assistant, Brittany Camuso, inside the executive mansion. In a statement, the Albany district attorney, David Soares, said, quote, "While we found the complainant in this case cooperative and credible, after review of all the available evidence, we've concluded we cannot meet our burden at trial," he said. Democratic Congressmember Bobby Rush of Illinois has announced he will retire and won't run for a 16th term. The former Black Panther was first elected in 1992. There are now two dozen House Democrats who are not seeking re-election. In California, a Republican lawyer and vocal critic of vaccine mandates has died after contracting COVID-19. Kelly Earnby was 46 years old. She worked as a deputy district attorney in Orange County. In December, she spoke at a rally against vaccine mandates, telling protesters, quote, "There's nothing that matters more than our freedoms right now." And today is Julian Assange's 1,000th day locked up in the Belmarsh High Security Prison in London. Supporters of the WikiLeaks founder are expected to rally outside the prison demanding his release and to oppose U.S. plans to extradite him for exposing U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alice Smith.
The world suffers the largest outbreak of disease in history. At the same time, climate disruption brings a heat wave to Alaska and Greenland, pushing Arctic air south where it should not be. Is this breakdown or turning point? We begin with new science on a fear almost greater than death, long-haul COVID. The monster COVID wave is hitting around the world like a tsunami, as you know. Formerly safe places like Australia and Vietnam have skyrocketing cases. Even Israel, now administering the fourth dose of vaccines and closing borders, they cannot contain this. Positive COVID tests in Europe are far higher than ever. The disease is conquering America and Canada. Russia continues to lose over 1,000 citizens a day. Hospitalizations are building again everywhere, but more slowly than expected. The best hope, sold by the media and desperate tweeters, goes like this. The new Omicron variant is mild, just a bad cold, sort of. Omicron pushes out the more deadly Delta variant and infects everyone, including all the unvaccinated. Humanity emerges in the spring with just another nasty flu that comes back every year. That sounds livable. Many politicians who tossed out restrictions to keep business going, well, maybe they were right. We might as well just keep on going and get our dose of COVID. Most people will be okay, we think. If you are happy with that, or in case you are genuinely depressed right now, you might want to change the channel or stop the podcast here. I'm serious. Protect yourself. In these times, we all need to cling on to whatever gets us through the day. Get out now if you need to, because this is harsh information. The dream of mild Omicron accidentally saving humanity from a more deadly strain is possible, but is it likely? As every expert says relentlessly on TV, we don't know. It is still too soon to tell how the Omicron variant will play out in the real world. In South Africa, the first giant wave of Omicron swept through in early December without a parallel wave of immediate hospitalizations. But immunologists pointed out two prime factors. The population of South Africa is much younger than in Europe or North America, and a large number of those infected may have built resistance from previously untested and unreported cases of earlier COVID variants. The South African experience may not apply. At the start of 2022, hospitalizations in South Africa are climbing again. In Britain, Omicron flourished to the point where 1 in 10 people on the streets of London tested positive for COVID at the end of December. Now, that's not 1 in 10 people who went in for testing because they thought they were sick, but 1 in 10 randomly selected people on the street. And yet, so far, hospitalizations have not completely overwhelmed the national healthcare system. That could change at any day. Also, the majority of people who tested positive for COVID in UK hospitals at the end of December were there for other reasons. They were not admitted because of COVID symptoms. That's amazing. We don't know what will happen in January. The United States is a special case. First of all, the population was led into a dangerous myth, not just by people pushing anti-science, but by the government's Center for Disease Control. The CDC helped that hopeful narrative that kinder, gentler Omicron had pushed out Delta. In early December, they reported that 73% of new cases were the Omicron variant. But on December 28th, the CDC made a major correction. Instead of 73% Omicron in the first 2 weeks of December, the true figure was 23%, a change of 50%. The majority of cases were deadly Delta. Who knows how many people let their guard down because of that? I think their guard was already down. But the Delta variant continued to overwhelm hospitals and kill thousands of Americans each and every day. There were two pandemics at the same time. Deadly Delta has not in any way left the United States, Canada, or Europe yet. One review of cases, still not peer-reviewed, appears to show that having Omicron seems to prevent Delta at the same time. Others argue co-infection is completely possible. We don't know for sure, especially from the experience in Israel, whether Omicron can infect people, even with three injections of vaccines. That seems to be the case. The virus has mutated to escape vaccine resistance, and it looks like triple-jab people still avoid the trip to intensive care or the morgue, unless they were already near the edge due to other non-COVID conditions. So don't count on immunity. Medical reports from several countries found people can be reinfected with COVID, getting it two or more times within a single year. So this is unlike other famous diseases. Surviving COVID does not create lifetime immunity or even immunity lasting a year. My personal conclusion is that people who have had COVID-19 of any variant, whether symptomatic or not, should take more, not less, protective measures. Cases on record show return COVID can be worse and more deadly than the first bout. Hopefully you can pass this message on to others. If someone got through COVID, it is not a get-out-of-jail-free card, not time to party. It is time to be extra vigilant and double-masked like an immunocompromised person, which that person may very well be. We need more science on that, but peer-reviewed large study results will come far too late to know what to do now for sure. Be careful. The giant and most fearsome ogre in our time is not really how many millions will die from COVID, their troubles will end while their families grieve. The media mentions this other dark fear in passing. Maybe a couple of famous people admit it. We hear more cries from victims on Twitters. Hey, watch out. You know what it is. Long-haul COVID. Early in the pandemic, we heard of low survival rates of people going on ventilators, like only 12% lived. Among those survivors, a minority of that minority experienced extreme impacts like full-on dementia at any age. Others had to learn to speak and walk again, like a toddler. It is hard to find the number of people who now require dialysis for the rest of their lives because of their COVID infection. Kidney damage, heart damage, and brain damage emerged in COVID survivors and sometimes even in those with mild symptoms. Others just lost their will to live, slipping into serious depression that lasts until today. Or they are tired, finding common ground with chronic fatigue syndrome, too tired to work, to look after their kids, to get their lives back. We do not know how long those symptoms will last. Organ damage to the kidneys and heart will not be repaired, we know that. They may be treated, but the person may die years younger than if they never had COVID. When this pandemic is over, it will not be over. It seems likely millions of people will die early due to COVID damage for the years and even decades after the disease. Most may not be counted. What we can say that is true now, just based on the lives already lost and damaged by the COVID-19 pandemic, is that widespread damage will continue as long as variants like Delta can find unvaccinated people. Given a big world with billions of humans, that could be decades. We can't say for sure. Will the Omicron variant cause the same kinds of long-term impacts? With a virus barely a month old, it is too soon to say with any scientific or medical certainty. We don't know yet. We can say that so far it looks like Omicron is having less severe impacts on most people who get it, especially if they are vaccinated, and that might reduce the continuing buildup of humans with long-haul COVID. A comparatively smaller number of Omicron patients require ventilators. If hospitalized, patients with Omicron stay only a few days, not weeks or months. It sounds like fewer people are dying of Omicron, but the big wave is just washing over. It is too soon to know. But we can hold on to that small hope that fewer people will suffer long-lasting damage when they get this new COVID variant. That is a good hope, and I'm holding on to it. There is no science to prove it yet, but we are getting the first explanations of how and when COVID-19 damages the heart, brain, and other organs.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Let's get straight to the breaking science on long-haul COVID. This was just released December 26th, led by scientists at the U.S. National Institute of Health. These are rushed results from fresh autopsies of American COVID victims. This information comes with a warning. It is preprint and, quote, should not be considered conclusive, used to inform clinical practice, or referenced by the media as validated information, end quote. Due to the enormous need to understand this virus as it attacks society around the world, The NIH is breaking their normal slow procedure for peer-reviewed data. There are 33 authors, most of them American medical scientists. The lead author is Dr. Daniel Chertow. He is the investigator for the Emerging Pathogens section of the NIH. The manuscript is under review for the top journal, Nature. The title is SARS-CoV-2 Infection and Persistence Throughout the Human Body and Brain. I post links to that paper in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Look for it, published Wednesdays. You should also look for an article by Jason Gale at medscape.com. Headline is Coronavirus Can Persist for Months After Traversing the Body. Jason writes, quote, "The coronavirus that causes COVID-19 can spread within days from the airwaves to the heart, brain, and almost every organ in the body, where it may persist for months, a study found." End quote. The best previous study on long-term effects was led by the director of the Clinical Epidemiology Center at the Veterans Affairs in St. Louis, Missouri, Dr. Ziad Al-Ali. We will look at his paper shortly. But Ziad Al-Ali told Jason Gale, quote, "For a long time now, we have been scratching our heads and asking why long COVID seems to affect so many organ systems. This paper sheds some light and may help explain why long COVID can occur even in people who had mild or asymptomatic acute disease," end quote. So what did the NIH scientists find in the bodies of COVID victims? The COVID RNA particles were found in the brain and in multiple parts of the body, lasting hundreds of days after symptoms began. The RNA, that is, the virus, is still there. It is still active, but can it be activated again? We don't know yet. But other viruses do have that capability, like the herpes virus, which hides in the bodies for years, erupting every now and then. We can't assume COVID-19 is like that, and we can't assume that it isn't. But even more telling for millions of people experiencing illness and disability long after getting this coronavirus, the new NIH study suggests the way that spreading can take place. The investigators found the virus goes through an early stage where it can explode out of the breathing system into the rest of the body. They are calling it a viremic stage. Take a deep breath. Not everyone experiences this all-body blast of the virus. In fact, the majority of people do not. Yet a minority, say 1% of people who get COVID, is a huge number of people when literally billions of folks are infected with the virus. In the UK's Guardian newspaper, December 23rd, disability activist J.D. Davids draws up these numbers for America, quote, "We now know that at least 10 to 30% of those who survive any COVID infection, from asymptomatic to mild to severe, will go on to live with, and sometimes die from, long COVID, a long-term, lifelong, or even life-threatening from COVID." Even before Omicron, the CDC estimates there have been at least 146.6 million COVID infections in the United States alone, meaning at least 15 million people are estimated to have long COVID. End quote from J.D. Davids in The Guardian. Find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. That 15 million figure is lower than others I have seen. It is just for the United States, and does not include whatever Omicron will leave in its wake in the year 2022 and possibly beyond.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, host of the show for the last 15 years. I usually interview climate scientists, but this week we have a special about new understanding of one of the most feared aspects of this pandemic virus, long-haul COVID. Here is the awful truth found by the latest science. It is already known to doctors and nurses in many intensive care units around the world. In some people, COVID kills neurons in the brain. Here is a tweet, a helpful one, from Dr. Noor Bari, an infectious diseases emergency trainee in Australia. Quote, "They found that the infected astrocytes induced apoptosis in the neurons, indicating that the virus infection could trigger events that could kill neurons." Translation? COVID makes your body kill your brain cells, and they don't grow back. That from Noor Bari is partly inspired by this paper published November 18, 2021 in Nature Reviews Neurology. The title is Counting the Neurological Cost of COVID-19. In it, an earlier review of reports from 55 countries found 41 different neurological manifestations occurring with COVID-19. The brain is so complex, damaging different parts of it reveals 41 different possible impacts. That is amazing, and that's just what's reported so far. A lot of people are experiencing strange changes in their lives and may never realize it was COVID damage to the brain. The most extreme signs of brain damage from the virus are like early onset dementia and Parkinson's disease. Although surviving, the person may require care for the rest of their shortened lives. Other symptoms seem like less, but they still loom pretty large if it's you. Memory problems are common, words going missing. The brain breakdown formerly associated with advancing age, but now it appears in 30 to 50-year-olds and younger, even kids. Some people with COVID lose detectable and measurable IQ points due to neurons killed off by the disease in the brain. Quoting from Counting the Neurological Cost, that study by Abdul Manan Baig, differences in the prevalence of the various neurological symptoms were observed between older, aged 60 years or more, and young, aged less than 18-year-olds, subpopulations. Acute confusion or delirium, fatigue, and myalgia tended to dominate in the older group. In patients under 18 years, the most common neurological symptoms were impairment of smell and/or taste and headache, and seizures were also noted in some individuals. Alarmingly, mortality in patients with COVID-19 who had one or more neurological manifestations was found to be 27% and was especially high in patients aged 60 years or more. The finding that the prevalence of stroke was 1.2% in people with COVID-19, compared with only 0.2% in those with influenza, is also very concerning. That's an end quote from Counting the Neurological Cost by Abdul Manan Baig. Find that link in my blog at ecoshock.org. Statistically speaking, this COVID brain damage probably has not happened to you, will not happen to you or your loved ones. But millions of people around you will be less able to work, to cope, and to understand what is happening to them. Take this back-of-the-envelope guesstimate from a tweeter who calls himself Abundant Pedestrian Sheds. Quote, let's do a bit more math. Let's say 70% get infected. 10% of that has long COVID. A UK study says 1 in 7, so 10% is conservative enough. That will give us roughly 23 million of people in the UK who will have apoptosis in brain cells and long COVID. Plus, reinfections are twice as likely to be fatal. That's from a tweeter. How about this one? Just consider from Denise DeWald, an MD in Ohio. How is the economy going to look if the average age of dementia onset is 60 years rather than 84? There is a measurable decline in cognitive function in people who had just one episode of COVID. What happens after multiple bouts with the virus, says Denise. Back comes this comment. Meanwhile, China is protecting its citizens' workforce. Hardcore. How will we compete if our populace is profoundly affected cognitively in years to come? Another commenter says, try from age 35. I am dealing with completely lost and confused people daily. We have already discussed, discreetly, screening those who have been infected when hiring. They are too great a burden for a business when thinking fast on your feet is essential. End of a quote from a tweet. Chilling. How many people will try to hide their COVID infection in job resumes? How deep will the new discrimination go? A factor in marriage partners? For more information on brain damage and cognitive deficits after COVID, you can check out this paper, published July 22, 2021, in the journal Lancet, Cognitive Deficits in People Who Have Recovered from COVID-19. Another study, published in the Lancet April 6, 2021, in a huge UK look at medical records, found 1 in 3 COVID patients developed either neurological or psychiatric problems in the first 6 months after their infection. Damage ranges from nervous disorders to depression to paranoia, and beyond that into antisocial behaviors. It can appear in COVID patients of all ages. That includes children, parents, and grandparents. I don't have time in this show to go into the psychiatric changes after COVID-19, but remember, that just hits a few. But in this game, a few is a lot, too many to count. As mentioned, Dr. Ziad Al-Ali published an important paper on long-haul COVID in April 2021. He is senior author of the study and a director of the Clinical Epidemiology Center at Veterans Affairs in St. Louis. In a news release from Washington University in St. Louis, Al-Ali said, "Our study demonstrates that up to 6 months after diagnosis, the risk of death following even a mild case of COVID-19 is not trivial and increases with disease severity. Given that more than 30 million Americans have been infected with this virus, and given that the burden of long COVID is substantial, the lingering effects of this disease will reverberate for many years and even decades." End quote. Al-Ali also warned that our current death tolls in every country are just the beginning. Quote, "As far as total pandemic death toll, these numbers suggest that the deaths we are counting due to the immediate viral infection are only the tip of the iceberg," end quote. As the WUSTL press release explains, quote, "For the Nature study, researchers examined more than 87,000 COVID-19 patients and nearly 5 million control patients in a federal database. They found COVID-19 patients had a 59% higher risk of death up to 6 months after infection, compared to non-infected people. These findings translate into about 8 extra deaths per 1,000 patients over 6 months, because many deaths caused by long-term COVID complications are not recorded as COVID-19 deaths," the researchers said. "Among patients who were hospitalized and died after more than 30 days, there were 29 excess deaths per 1,000 patients over 6 months," end quote, from that press release. In this meta-study of about 74,000 patient records held by the Veterans Administration, the Al-Ali paper found COVID-19 can result in, get ready for it, respiratory system, persistent cough, shortness of breath, and low oxygen levels in the blood, nervous system, stroke, headaches, memory problems, and problems with senses of taste and smell, mental health, anxiety, depression, sleep problems, and substance abuse, metabolism, new onset of diabetes, obesity, and high cholesterol, cardiovascular system, acute coronary disease, heart failure, heart palpitations, and irregular heart rhythms, gastrointestinal system, constipation, diarrhea, and acid reflux, kidney, acute kidney injury, and chronic kidney disease that can, in severe cases, require dialysis, coagulation regulation, blood clots in the legs and lungs, skin, rash and hair loss, musculoskeletal system, joint pain and muscle weakness, general health, malaise, fatigue, and anemia. That ends a long list from a study of tens of thousands of people. And that's what can happen after COVID-19. It will happen to a minority of people, but that minority will be a huge number of people. Let's care for them. People who worry they have long-haul COVID, or know that they do, or who need to support someone who does have it, can try the Survivor Corps, a grassroots group, at www.survivorcorps.com, and Corps has an S on the end of it. Okay, it's time to talk about the massive risk of Omicron evolving into a new variant. One final awful truth to get through here. The historic infection of billions of people worldwide in a few months greatly increases the odds a new and worse variant of COVID will develop and escape. Even if this one is milder, which we don't know yet, the worldwide virus factory growing in so many people is another darkening cloud on the time horizon. Early in the pandemic, immunologists explained a new COVID variant could develop within a single sick person. Each person with the virus has billions of copies of it. Medical scientists suggest that someone who survives a long time while sick with one COVID variant is a possible bioreactor where a new variant can form. Actually, every person with COVID becomes a new bioreactor, an experimental chamber for the virus to try and try again countless new variations. It only requires one, even more successful variation to reconquer the human herd and a lot of other mammals. By the way, a third of the deer tested in Ohio tested positive for COVID-19. Whatever strain the deer have is probably going to be endemic in humans where infected wildlife is present, and they don't have herd immunity either. If you want to collect up all your COVID fears and put them on the table, don't forget the massively increased risk of new variants as uncontrolled Omicron and the remains of Delta blow up disease records around the world right now. As doctors like Peter Hotez and Eric Fagelding continually warn, the more cases we have, the more chance of dangerous variants developing, perhaps to escape any vaccine or treatment we have now. The greatest wave of disease ever seen on Earth carries the awful seed, the possibility of even worse to come. Or maybe not. Remember the first SARS-1? Far more lethal than SARS-2, which we call COVID-19. It evolved away from human hosts. A vaccine for SARS-1 was just developed, but never used because a new variation disappeared from human experience. It was a warning shot. A small group of virus experts, and eventually Bill Gates, got the message. Sadly, governments and the public did not, and here we are. But if this is our darkest hour, remember, the virus has no planning intelligence. It changes through billions of trials by brute force of numbers to see what succeeds better. We have failed to fight off the virus, but the virus can fail too. That hope remains. Whether Omicron saves us from more deadly Delta or new treatments for acute illness arrive during 2022, we can be sure that the impact of this viral event will last for decades. Millions of people have already lost key functions, with damage in organs and reduced energy to live their full lives. Their lifespans could be shorter. Even the average life expectancy could be reduced, including in developed countries. Now we face coping with millions of injured people. Hordes of Americans already lost their health care along with their jobs. Those who are too sick and tired to work may not get medical care. But it goes deeper than providing basic living or even health care. This pandemic is going to require something else. It has been in short supply this last decade. Caring for others, including people who look or speak differently. In history, religion has stepped in to provide emotional and spiritual support for those in need. Charity is built into Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. But all three religions are declining in the age of science and modernity. Will a frightened people return to former faiths and customs? Will we see a religious revival? If not, the pandemic may force a new function into civilization from Asia to Arkansas. We need a new social mechanism to care for our wounded. This includes hundreds of thousands of kids who lost their parents, the new COVID orphans. It includes the bright college professor who lost the IQ needed to keep on teaching. It includes the Amazon warehouse worker now stuck in bed at home without support or benefits. It includes the Indian farmer who can't support the family. Millions of COVID injured now need help from the survivors. That is our challenge in a time when selling hate and division is so profitable. Can the pandemic finally bring out the best in us? Anything is possible. I'm Alex Smith. Find links to all the science and news I just talked about, plus this audio MP3 is a free download in my show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
When the Arctic reemerges from its long sleep in the cold, everything from port cities to global weather are affected. But is anybody watching the big picture there? The U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration just issued their 2021 Arctic Report Card update. A lead editor of that report is glaciologist Twyla Moon. Dr. Moon is deputy lead scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado. From Boulder, Colorado, Twyla Moon, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Without a lie, most of us are transfixed by the pandemic, but we do have to be able to pay attention to more than one thing at a time. Did the Arctic continue to change in fundamental ways in 2021?
There is no question that rapid change has continued across the Arctic. 2021 was no exception. 2021 was not a year of significant new records in regards to, you know, record-breaking temperatures. But nonetheless, there were still unprecedented events that occurred in the Arctic, and we are seeing dramatic changes that include landscapes, animals, frozen elements of the Arctic. So it's an area of concern.
Well, there was one record set. Just a couple of weeks ago, the World Meteorological Organization verified the highest temperature ever recorded in the Arctic. In June 2021, I think it was, the Siberian town experienced an astonishing 38 degrees C or over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. What does the report card say about rising temperatures and even maybe heat waves in the Arctic?
You are correct. That is a new single-day record temperature recording. For the year overall, and the Arctic report card generally looks at the year from October of one year through September of the next year. That way we capture the period, the frozen period in winter, and then the thawing period in summer. And over October 2020 to September 2021 was actually the seventh warmest year on record for the Arctic. But this is another year, the eighth consecutive year, where that surface air temperature in the Arctic is more than 1 degree Celsius above the long-term average. And the Arctic is warming faster than the rest of the globe. It depends on the season and exactly the time period you look at, but those rates can be as much as four times faster than warming in other parts of the globe.
Yes, I saw that in a tweet from Zeke Labe, I believe that's how you pronounce his name, from the University of Colorado, saying that the Arctic is warming nearly four times faster than the global average. That seems so impossible. How is that happening?
There are a few different factors at play that are helping the Arctic warm faster, and this is a process overall that we refer to as Arctic amplification. One of the processes at play is that as we're losing sea ice on the Arctic Ocean, that sea ice is producing a nice, bright, fairly white surface that, just like wearing a white t-shirt, is pretty good at reflecting solar radiation back out to space. But as we lose that sea ice, we reveal a very, very dark ocean surface. And thinking to pictures you've seen of the Earth from space, that the ocean almost looks black in instances. And that ocean, dark ocean surface, is very good at absorbing additional solar radiation. And then that heat in the ocean can then be released during fall and into winter, causing delayed warming there. And another process that we have happening in the Arctic is that as we're warming the air temperature, the air is actually better able to hold water vapor. And water vapor is, in fact, a greenhouse gas. So as we're having more water vapor in the atmosphere in the Arctic as it warms, we're also warming the temperature.
Do you think the changes in the Arctic have helped destabilize weather further south in both summer and winter?
Yes, there is now clear evidence. This has been a very active area of research, and there are results now indicating ways in which the Arctic does reach down and influence storms, for example, in lower and mid-latitudes. And there are actually quite a few ways in which the Arctic is connected to all of us who are sitting far away from the Arctic. That includes influencing storms and weather, also influencing sea level rise and the effects at our coast. And the Arctic also has a lot of frozen ground or permafrost. And as that thaws, it can also release additional greenhouse gases to the atmosphere and cause additional warming that influences us far away from the Arctic.
I thought I would see more about the permafrost in this new report card. I'm wondering, is a lack of data holding up what we know? I mean, just about the greenhouse gases that may come out there and the landscape changes, it seems like a big deal.
There are significant changes in the permafrost. The Arctic report card is set up so that we have seven what we call vital signs, which are metrics that we look at every year in the Arctic report card. And then we have indicators, and those we come back to every couple of years. And permafrost is one of those indicators that shows up every few Arctic report cards. And then we also have essays that we term frost bites, and these are sort of emerging themes or research areas in the Arctic. And this year we had a section focusing on glacier and permafrost hazards. So not just the state of thawing ground in the Arctic, but what are these kinds of hazards that are caused as we get glacial melt happening, destabilizing ground as we thaw, permafrost, and this can produce large landslides. Sometimes those are coastal, and those can end up in the water and producing large tsunamis. So there are really critical threats both to infrastructure, buildings, and as well as to lives as we see changing glacier and permafrost in the Arctic.
And on this show, we recently heard Canadian scientist Michelle McChrystal talking about new science showing the Arctic will get more rain than snow in the future, and it's already starting to happen. How important is that?
Yes, that is a big change, and it is an important one. It's related to what we've been referring to in this Arctic report card as an intensification of the hydrologic cycle. So we see more precipitation happening as rain. One of the ways that we see this increased water hydrologic activity is by a trend of increasing river discharge across the Arctic as well. But I think one of the challenges is that this increase in kind of moisture water activity isn't equal everywhere or all across the seasons. So, for example, in our river discharge section, which is another one of these metrics we revisit every few years, some of the data from 2020 indicates that there was extraordinarily large river discharge in May of 2020, for example, for Eurasian Arctic rivers. But then that was followed by an extraordinarily low discharge in June. So we can have this kind of flip-flopping of extremes. And we can also see how some of these differences around the Arctic play out, for example, in the greenness of the tundra vegetation, which overall the Arctic is greening. And we've had some remarkably green years recently. But because of local extreme events or other local instances of what's happening with the weather, we can also see browning occurring.
In your TEDx talk in Montana, you told the audience it's not too late to prevent major changes in Earth's climate. But when it comes to the ice world, NASA says the collapse of Antarctica's Thwaites Glacier is, quote, unstoppable. And other scientists suggest the big melt has already been triggered in the Arctic. Can we really stop now the decline of the ice world? What do you think?
Well, I think what is so important to emphasize here is not A to Z, but rather how quickly these changes are happening. So we're at a point where future sea level rise is going to occur, and over the next couple of decades, that sea level rise may look similar regardless of whether we have very high or very low emissions. But a couple of decades from now, around 2050, computer simulations suggest that we'll start to see this divergence that is fully dependent on human action now. And that divergence is the beginning to experiencing very, very different sea level rise outcomes. If we have strong action and really work to reduce greenhouse gas and polluting gas emissions and tackle climate change, we will be seeing a much slower rate of sea level rise, and we're likely not to get to some of the higher numbers that have been discussed for at minimum centuries, but maybe millennia. That, in contrast to continuing to produce a lot of polluting gases and raising global temperatures, is really going to increase and keep sea level rise happening quickly and also reaching very high values. So some of these processes are underway, and we can't at this point stop them from happening, but human action still has a very big control on how quickly these changes happen. And the more we can slow these changes, the more time we give ourselves and our communities and economies, coastlines, time to adapt.
And then we have an idea from John Moore, a scientist with institutions in Beijing and Finland. He argued, if trillions of dollars of coastal real estate is at risk, and it is, we should try to slow the flow of new water coming from a relatively small number of glaciers. He suggests we could do it with geoengineering. Is that a good idea?
Yes, I'm quite familiar with some of his ideas on polar geoengineering. And I want to be clear, geoengineering is a very broad umbrella. And in order to reach some of our temperature targets, for example, reaching 1.5 degrees Celsius by 2100, limiting our warming to that number, does require that we use technologies that remove carbon dioxide and other polluting gases from the atmosphere. And certainly that is a form of geoengineering in which we're removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and storing that in permanent ways. And that is a very important part of reaching some of our goals for limiting warming. But there are also other forms of geoengineering, such as the ideas that he's put forth, which suggest some very local infrastructure that I tend to shy away from recommending as activities for us to undertake. Many of them are logistically difficult or unproven, and work in polar environments is also fantastically difficult and also expensive. Rather than putting Band-Aids on these more local issues, if we are really focusing on the root cause of changes in the Arctic, that is climate change, and that root cause is also affecting many of the other challenges we're experiencing, like increased wildfires, additional drought, more flooding. And so we can focus on this root cause and have an impact that is going to influence many of these different areas where we've been having challenges with environmental disasters.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock, and we're talking with our guest, Twyla Moon. So does the accumulated mass of the glaciers drive them to move faster? And if so, could the melt eventually slow down as the world continues to warm?
An important part of being a glacier on the Earth, an important part of that definition is that that ice is moving. So if you have an area of some permanent ice, but it's not moving, it might be quite small, we would consider that a permanent ice field or snow field. But the world's glaciers, ice caps, which cover Patagonia, the Andes, Himalaya, as well as the Earth's large ice sheets, Greenland and Antarctica, all of these are defined by that ice being in motion. And ice around the world is not all responding in the same way as far as how it's changing its speed. And largely that's because it depends on the shape of the landscape and topography underneath that ice, whether, for example, around Greenland, where we see all of the edge of the ice sheet there is in retreat. And there, in some instances, we have glaciers that are retreating actually into deeper topography underneath them, and that causes that glacier to speed up. While another glacier may be retreating up higher onto land, and that can cause that glacier to slow down. So the speed of ice motion is not intrinsically always in one direction or another with climate change. Unfortunately, how quickly ice moves is not the only thing that is adding ice to our ocean. We're having surface melt. We can break off large chunks of frozen ice as icebergs, and that melts in the ocean. So we're losing ice mass, not simply by increasing its pace towards the ocean.
And several of our scientific guests report big changes in the timing of snow cover on Arctic lands from Alaska to Canada and Siberia. How important is that?
Yes, this is a very important issue. Snow cover has a lot to do with when we're getting water resources on the landscape, and this has been an area of change as well. For example, we've been tracking terrestrial snow cover on land, since 1967 in Eurasian Arctic, and there, June 2021 saw the third lowest values in that record, beginning there in the late 1960s. So snow cover really has been below average at this point for quite some time, now for 15 consecutive years in the North American Arctic. And this is a challenge for animals and also for water resources and humans who depend on these water resources and ecosystems too.
Yes, I noticed in the 2021 Arctic Report card there was more emphasis on the changes for humans who live there. Do you want to talk to us about that a little?
That's true. We have been feeling recently that we would really like the Arctic Report card to help people understand that there's a significant population of people living in the Arctic, and they are really needing to rely on communities, neighbors, traditions, and find ways to be resilient in the face of these changes. And so we've been looking for ways to be able to discuss the people influences that all of these Arctic changes have, not just for those of us far from the Arctic, but also for residents of the Arctic, and discuss how they've been dealing with some of these changes occurring.
The Arctic Report card says, quote, seven of the nine Arctic regions observed show higher ocean primary productivity in 2021 than the long-term average. What does that mean, and why does it matter?
Yes, primary productivity helps us think about really the base of the Arctic Ocean food chain. And it's not entirely clear what this higher primary productivity, how that might lead to other ecosystem changes, because there are other changes going on, for example, losses of sea ice that are really challenging to some of our marine animals. So it's unclear still the full influence of this increase in primary productivity. And I do want to point out that this increase in primary productivity, much as we discussed with tundra greening, where we could have this kind of pan-Arctic greening of the vegetation, primary productivity is an area where we can also see extreme or unusual events that show low productivity for specific locations or times of year, too. So across these different metrics that look at the full Arctic or might sum up an entire year, there are a lot of really interesting and important nuances location to location, as well as we look at different seasons.
It appears Greenland lost less ice in 2021 than in previous years. Does that mean we're doing better at controlling climate change, or what?
I sure wish that I could say that was true. It is good news that this was not another record year of ice loss from the Greenland ice sheet. I, as a person who myself focuses my own research most specifically on the Greenland ice sheet, I'm always glad to see a year where ice loss is a bit less. Nonetheless, this is now another year, and it's now been every year since 1998 that we have seen ice loss from the Greenland ice sheet, and any ice loss is contributing to shrinking of the ice sheet and to sea level rise around the world. And interestingly, even in spite of having this somewhat lower ice loss this year than some of the recent years that we've seen, there were still some remarkable and unprecedented events for the Greenland ice sheet. This summer, we actually had three extreme melt events on the Greenland ice sheet, and was only the second summer on record. The other was 2012, which was a record ice loss year, in which we had two different extreme melt events where more than half of the ice sheet surface was experiencing melt at the same time. And we also had another very, well, unprecedented event, and that was in mid-August. There's a research station up at the summit of the Greenland ice sheet. This is more than 10,000 feet, more than 3,000 meters above sea level rise, really in the deep interior of the ice sheet. And the scientists there experienced hard rain at the summit. And we've never before recorded rain at the summit of the ice sheet.
Well, one of the best known indicators is the Arctic sea ice. The public has heard about that. What can you say about that this year?
Arctic sea ice, this was another year of low Arctic sea ice. Thankfully, it was not a record low for the extent. So there are many, many metrics that we look at for sea ice. One of them is imagining looking down from space and how much area is that sea ice covering. And this was not a record minimum, which we measure usually in September. However, the 15 lowest extents have all occurred in the last 15 years, which is kind of another way of saying that the ice extents that we saw prior to 2007, we haven't been able to recover to those kinds of quantities or area coverage of sea ice. And along with measuring this area covered by sea ice, we also think about the age and the thickness of the sea ice. So sea ice that stays around through a summer is going to, in that following winter, grow more. So it's gaining another year of age, and it's also usually getting thicker. And unfortunately, this, what we call multi-year sea ice, has seen very dramatic losses. And for 2021, we saw our second lowest levels of multi-year sea ice, and this based on a record that began in 1985. So we're losing some of this important, older, thicker ice in the Arctic.
There's a couple of strange new developments in the new report card, like a garbage event and the impact of beavers. Why include that?
Well, these are areas where we're looking as Arctic Report Card editors for areas of new research or sometimes surprising events. And we noticed news from local communities on these marine garbage events were really remarkable. They were having reports of amounts of garbage that they'd never seen before in the coastal areas. This was in the Bering Strait, which is the kind of coastal area of Alaska in this case, where Alaska is kind of reaching over towards the Russian side as well. And they were seeing remarkable amounts of garbage, and also that much of this garbage seemed to be quite new. And as we're losing sea ice in the Arctic, and as animals and fish are migrating sometimes further north than before, residents in the Arctic are experiencing the impacts of more industrial shipping activity in the Arctic. And unfortunately, this garbage event appears to be part of that trend and helps to remind us that there's really a lot of international activity in the Arctic, and it's going to require international cooperation if, for example, we're going to prevent having more of these garbage events into the future. And I think as far as the beaver expansion into the Arctic, this was an area that has been noted by Arctic residents in Alaska. And they've been noting more beaver instances. And as scientists were beginning to look at data collected from satellites, they were measuring how many beaver ponds there were in the Alaska tundra. And they found that the number of beaver ponds had doubled since 2000. And as beavers create these surface ponds, it creates a watery, wet surface, and that actually can also add to destabilizing the permafrost or frozen ground underneath it. So it's not entirely clear what is going to be the extent of the transformation of the ecosystem in the Arctic due to this expansion of beavers, but it may not be sort of the positive beaver story that we sometimes have in lower mid-latitudes.
From so many scientists, we hear developments in the Arctic will change the whole world. I wonder, do you think we need a single, well-funded agency to monitor the far north more, or is it enough to depend on spending by national governments?
I certainly welcome additional focus on the Arctic, and I think that the realization of how important the Arctic is has continued to grow, and I mean realizing the importance of it as part of our Earth system and really part of the Earth's cooling system, but also an increased realization that there's a lot of activity there geopolitically, a lot of changes underway that are going to influence shipping, economies, industrial activity. And so I think that many area groups are playing catch-up to being attentive to the changes occurring in the Arctic. And I'll be honest, I'm not entirely sure whether we would be better served by introducing a new organization or agency that would focus entirely on this, or by increasing our efforts to weave together the different groups and activities that do look at the Arctic. But I think there's no question that the Arctic is becoming an increasingly important area for us to pay attention to, and for a variety of reasons.
Well, I think along with my listeners, I kind of worry that there could be a major tipping point occurring there, but it's so far away from the rest of us that it could go on until we don't notice it too late.
I agree that it's very important that we have ongoing monitoring activities, and some of them can be very challenging. For example, we have an essay this year on ocean acidification, and measurements at areas of the Arctic suggest that it may be experiencing higher ocean acidification rates than anywhere else on the globe in areas of the Arctic Ocean. But it's such a difficult area to study. It's a very difficult environment to have instruments in or set up long-term monitoring. So we're thankful for the many resources that come from satellites, although few of them can really take data all the way to the North Pole. And there are many challenges with doing research in the field. So I think scientists are working hard to bring many different tools and also invent new tools that can help with this. But I agree that it's an area of concern as far as being attentive to the changes happening. And I think not just for the Arctic, but for climate change broadly, we should be quite concerned about taking rapid action so that the changes that we implement can take effect sooner rather than later, because there are enough of these vicious amplifying loops that get started and then continue that I'm quite concerned that we don't get to a point where we have delayed action so long that the actions we take will have little influence. Whereas we're at a time right now where we can see quite clearly from computer simulations that taking action can have a large influence.
Twyla, as we wrap up here, I notice that you've been exploring and publishing science about this for over a dozen years. You seem to take it kind of personally. Do you feel like you've developed a relationship with some of the glaciers?
There's no question that I feel like I have a relationship with some of these glaciers. I have been studying the Greenland ice sheet for going on 2 decades, and it's amazing to me, even the smallest little area of Greenland, if it was a natural feature, for example, here in my backyard in Montana, it would be considered a national treasure and everyone would be going to visit it. But because Greenland is somewhat remote and it's so large, some of these glaciers maybe barely have names, but I have come to recognize them and see the changes. And unfortunately, the ice sheet that I see and monitor today is already very different from the ice sheet that I fell in love with as a student, and it's difficult to watch these changes happen. But the ice sheet also reminds me that we are still in such an important opportunity space and that we're really undertaking actions today that will create a legacy that lasts for tens of thousands of years. And I cannot think of a more exciting place to be involved than taking actions for the Earth system that are really going to last for millennia.
From Boulder, Colorado, we've been speaking with Dr. Twyla Moon, Deputy Lead Scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center. You can find links to the Arctic Report Card update at arctic.noaa.gov, or you can find easy links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Corporations and Propaganda, Managing Public Opinion by Alex Carey. The little-known Australian sociologist and psychologist Alex Carey, at his death in 1988, left behind a set of unpublished manuscripts that traced the history of propaganda in the U.S. from World War I to the Reagan era, a treasure in the eyes of notables such as Noam Chomsky. It is the first, and to this day only, history of a three-quarter century effort of social engineering and corporate propaganda in the U.S. The aim was to undermine democracy, destroy the union movement, and to establish the unfettered rights of industry and the so-called free market system. Even Thomas Jefferson predicted that corporate power could undermine freedom and democracy. Those who feel today that democracy has failed ought to consider Alex Carey's well-documented report of the most intense and most expensive sales campaign that corporations have ever undertaken. Democracy did not fall, Carey says, but it was dismantled, and it is surely in crisis today. Last week, you heard the amazing story of the first government-sponsored wartime propaganda effort of World War I under leadership of the nephew of Sigmund Freud, Edward Bernays. Through the story of defeat in the Palmer Raids, the resurgence of democratic rights during the Depression, Alex Carey brought us up to World War II. Again, as during World War I, the American people believed that the ideal of freedom and democracy, for which they were asked to fight and die, applied to them as well. And again, like in 1919-1920, the late 40s and early 50s became an era of backlash and defeat, beginning with the McCarthy era. Ed Markman is the reader of the manuscript by Alex Carey.
The post-war victory of corporate propaganda. During the McCarthy period, business first beat back the unions with the Taft-Hartley Act and then secured a shift to conservatism in American politics similar to the shift which followed its campaigns of 1919-1920. In December 1945, the NAM summarized its use of newspapers and radio during 1945.
Every day, one or more news stories about the National Association of Manufacturers appears in newspapers in some part of the country, and often in all newspapers in all parts of the country. On the airwaves this year, NAM members, officers, and committees spoke directly with the public for a total of 1,350 hours of time, or 56 full 24-hour days. Their words reached into the homes of Americans and into the barracks of Americans stationed in all parts of the world.
By 1946, the NAM was only one of a great number of business-sponsored organizations that were cooperating to drench the country with anti-communist, anti-socialist, anti-union, and anti-New Deal propaganda.
When will the plain, ordinary, sincere, yet sheep-like people of America awaken to the fact that their common affairs are being arranged and run for them by aliens, communists, crackpot refugees, renegades, socialist termites and traitors? If you, the American people, don't get busy and fight, this whole vicious plot will be slipped over on you without your knowing what hit you. What's wrong? I'll tell you what's wrong. We have robbed man of his liberty. We have taught the American businessman until he is afraid to sign his name to a paycheck for the fear he is violating some bureaucratic rule that will call for the surrender of a bond, the appearance before a committee, or even imprisonment itself. We are going to take the government out of the hands of these city slickers and give it back to the people that still believe that two and two is four.
The United States Chamber of Commerce was one such organization. Their annual report summarizes one very specific part of its activities during 1946-47, the distribution of large pamphlets of some 50 pages each.
1946, More than a million copies of the chamber pamphlet Communist Infiltration in the United States were distributed and received with shock surprise in many quarters. 1947, Communists Within the Government, a chamber publication, brought screams of anguish, not only from known communists, but from others. A cabinet officer sought its withdrawal. However, the government's loyalty program, inadequate but still a loyalty program, was begun.
Many of the country's largest firms, Fortune magazine observed in 1950, have started extensive programs to indoctrinate employees. The American Advertising Council represents large corporations and large advertising agencies. In April 1947, the council announced a $100 million advertising program, which, over the next 12 months, would use all media to sell the American economic system to the American people. The program was officially described as a major project of educating the American people about the economic facts of life. Daniel Bell, then an editor of Fortune, provides a perspective on both the scale and the anti-union and anti-New Deal purposes of these campaigns.
It has been industry's prime concern in the post-war years to change the climate of opinion ushered in by the Depression. This free enterprise campaign has two essential aims: to re-win the loyalty of the worker which now goes to the union, and to halt creeping socialism. In short, the campaign has had the definite aim of seeking to shift the Democratic majority of the last 20 years into the Republican camp. The output is staggering. By all odds, it adds up to the most intensive sales campaign in the history of industry.
American businesses' pre- and post-war assaults on public opinion had a double objective: to turn the public against the Democratic administration of Roosevelt and Truman and their liberal supporters, and to turn it against the growing power of the trade union movement that resulted from the Wagner Act of 1935. The first objective was achieved with the McCarthy period and the election of Eisenhower in 1952.
Dwight D. Eisenhower, the 34th President of the United States.
We must be ready to dare all for our country. For history does not long entrust the care of freedom to the weak or the timid. A people that values its privileges above its principles soon loses both.
During World War II, business made unprecedented profits while wages remained controlled. When the war ended, business had, in addition to its long-term objective of weakening the union movement, two immediate concerns: to minimize wage rises and maximize price rises. At the 1946 elections, labor problems was one of the chief political issues on which the Republicans won control of Congress. The NAM took the initiative and drafted a new labor law and arranged for its submission to the new Congress. The Taft-Hartley Act, passed in 1947, embodied the NAM's proposals completely, except for a ban on industry-wide bargaining. Not surprisingly, it placed tremendous obstacles in the way of the new organization of workers. Public opinion, however muddled, did no longer support the unions. It was the force which backed the new curbs on unions enacted in the post-war years. The General Motors strikes, like most of the other important strikes in the 1945-46 upsurge, were fought not on the picket line, but in Washington and in the press and over the radio. The outcome was that while unions won the strikes, business won the public relations battle, with the Taft-Hartley Act as its prize. Apart from years affected by the Korean War, the American labor movement was never again able to increase the low proportion of the workforce it had organized. 30 years later, in the face of a renewed propaganda and public relations onslaught by business in the 1970s, organized labor in the United States went into a steep and possibly terminal decline. By the end of 1946, the business campaigns have paid off. Public opinion condemned the strikes of 1945-46. Unions came off with worse public relations than companies. A survey shows that the public thought that companies had higher regard for the public interest than the unions, and even union members were now less favorably disposed towards their own unions. The public now associated unions with mass picketing and violence, although there was no violence in the strikes of the past years. The midterm elections of 1946 marked labor's worst defeat since Hoover's day. a truly amazing victory for corporate public relations. Alex Carey then goes on to describe the 50s as an era where corporations tried to find ways to replace the unions. The Wagner Act had made it illegal to use company unions as a way of preempting unions, so the companies had to search for other avenues. This search became officially known as the Human Relations Movement. It embraced such notions as employee participation, employee communication, and democratic decision-making. Sounds familiar? Vast amounts of money all of a sudden became available for the study of human relations in industry. Peter Drucker, doyen of American Management Consultants, said in 1950, with amazing frankness, that, quote, "Most of us in management have instituted human relations as a way of busting the unions." That trend continued through the 50s. Looking back at that decade, Professor Robert Dahl of Columbia finds very little difference between democracy and totalitarianism.
If political preferences are simply plugged into the system by leaders, business or other, in order to extract what they want from the system, then the model of electoral democracy is substantially equivalent to the model of totalitarian rule.
Propaganda in the 70s, Chapter 3 of Alex Carey's study on managing public opinion, the corporate offensive. The corporate campaigns to influence and change public opinion during the pre- and post-war periods had been largely directed at the grassroots, with a primary purpose of reaching large numbers of people directly and thereby changing public opinion. These campaigns continue into the 70s, and they are necessary. First Vietnam, then Watergate produced a disastrous collapse in public regard for all American institutions and for business in particular. So in 1975, the Advertising Council again initiated a national program of conservative economic education on a scale similar to the post-war program. In 1977, Fortune described the continuing Ad Council campaign as a study in gigantism, saturating the media and reaching practically everybody. By 1978, according to expert witnesses before a congressional inquiry, American business was spending $1 billion per year on grassroots propaganda. The effectiveness of the new propaganda program was monitored by a standardized, vastly detailed poll sponsored by the Advertising Council and repeated every 12 months. By 1980, the annual poll showed that the proportion of Americans who think there is too much government regulation, a matter at the very heart of the new right propagandists' concerns, had risen from 42% to 60%. Ronald Reagan's election followed. A New York firm which specializes in monitoring public opinion for business reviewed the changed mood of American politics and observed,
"Between Jimmy Carter's election in 1976 and Ronald Reagan's victory in 1980, the outlook of the American people underwent one of those decisive shifts that historians generally label as watershed events."
The review speculates about possible explanations for the startling reversal of public opinion, but it entirely overlooks business's billion-dollar propaganda campaigns. Again, as in 1919-21 and 1945-50, a business-sponsored assault on public opinion coincides with a dramatic swing to conservatism. And still, the meaning of all this for democracy is not raised in any substantial way. Yet another form of propaganda has developed in the 70s. It is the hallmark of the emerging neoconservative movement, and Alex Carey calls it, as distinct from the traditional grassroots, the treetops propaganda. What you're about to hear now is a chapter on think tanks and their role in the election of Ronald Reagan from Alex Carey's study, Managing Public Opinion, The Corporate Offensive. The 1970s in the United States and United Kingdom. Treetops propaganda. Treetops propaganda is not directed at the person in the street. It is directed to influencing a select audience of influential people, policymakers in Parliament and the civil service, newspaper editors and columnists, economics debate on TV and radio. Its immediate purpose is to set the terms of debate, to determine the kind of questions that will dominate public discussion. In a word, to set the political agenda in ways which are favorable to corporate interests. As this tactic succeeds, public discussion no longer assumes, for example, that affluent societies have a first responsibility to provide jobs for all who want them, and the debate is instead about whether 6% or 10% is a natural, and by implication, acceptable level of unemployment. It is no longer taken for granted that we have a right to clean air, and the debate centers on how far the cost to industry of pollution control is economically acceptable. The debate ceases to be about how far it is necessary for government to be involved in the economy and centers on arguments for reduced involvement and schedules for achieving this. The debate is no longer about whether unions have too much power or even too little power given the huge size of contemporary corporations, but about which is the best way to reduce that power. The tactics by which such changes in the political agenda are secured is for the corporations to search out articulate conservative economists and amenable academics, gather them together in lavishly funded, tax-deductible think tanks, and pay them handsomely to inundate relevant debate with an endless stream of books and research reports. In the U.S., the work of the many private think tanks which develop policies on a range of national issues is known as policy research. Such organizations have been around for a long time, some more right-wing, like the Conference Board and the Hoover Institution, others less right-wing, like the Brookings Institution and the Committee for Economic Development. The 1970s saw the emergence of an aggressive new breed among these organizations, which, lavishly funded by corporations, produced an incessant flow of market-oriented studies. Perhaps most importantly, the new think tanks placed a quite new emphasis on promoting and disseminating their products nationwide, that is, on proselytizing. The new or revitalized think tanks and the scholars they recruited virtually created the neoconservative movement of the 1970s. I would like to add here another observation from Noam Chomsky, an observation that addresses the particular danger of propaganda that is directed not at the people at large, but at the educated parts of the population.
One reason that propaganda often works better on the educated than on the uneducated is that educated people read more, so they receive more propaganda. Another is that they're the commissars. They have jobs as agents of propaganda, and they believe it. By and large, they're part of the privileged elite and share their interests and perceptions. The rest of the population is more marginalized. It doesn't participate in the democratic system, which is overwhelmingly an elite game.
Such propaganda directed at the educated, the elites, at lawmakers, as well as those who interpret the laws, is the main function of think tanks. The most important of the new think tanks is the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research, AEI, founded in 1943 with money from Lilly Endowment, Ford, Weyerhaeuser, and Reader's Digest. AEI gained such importance during the first Reagan campaign that it assumed almost mythical powers with Reagan's first election and, according to the New York Times, a consultant to frustrated Democratic Party members told them, quote, "They ought to remember that AEI did not win the election, but that Reagan did," end of quote. Reagan himself, however, gratefully acknowledged the support he had received from AEI. One of the first visits he paid to anyone after his election was to the AEI, where he received a standing ovation. Reagan addressed the meeting and said, quote, "I just want you to know that we'll be looking closely at your observations and proposals. This kind of working relationship with the AEI is one the next administration wants to maintain during the next 4 years." End of Reagan quote. Reagan then proceeded to choose six top appointees for his first administration from the pool of AEI scholars. As a cheerleader for the free market economy, the Heritage Foundation organizes communication among what it calls a resource bank of 1,000 academics and several hundred other policy research groups. In 1978, the president of the foundation, Dr. Foner, addressed an international conference of corporate opinion managers assembled in London. The American public policy arena, he reported happily, is awash with in-depth academic studies, which lead to the inescapable conclusion that the free market operates more efficiently, more humanely, and less expensively than any planned statist or socialist alternative. The last American think tank I shall discuss is the Business Roundtable. Founded in 1972, the Roundtable comprises the CEOs of 194 of America's largest corporations. Its membership represents approximately half the GNP of the U.S. The Roundtable's GNP is greater than the GNP of any country in the world apart from the U.S. In the same year it was founded, Justice Lewis Powell, shortly later elevated to the Supreme Court by the Nixon administration, wrote a famous memorandum for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which was a virtual manifesto for the neoconservative movement. In it, Powell urged business to buy the top academic reputations in the country to add credibility to corporate studies and give business a stronger voice on the campuses. A study by Ralph Nader's organization observes that the Roundtable buys supporting research through the hiring of expensive consultants and the sponsoring of academic studies. Money generates information in the form of studies and position papers, and the Roundtable has access to all the money it needs. The dominant purpose leading to its formation, the Nader Report finds, was a desire to combat and reduce union power, and it proclaims moderation while sabotaging moderate reform. Roundtable members consider their defeat of labor law reform and consumer protection bills in 1977-78 to be their biggest victories. It is instructive to consider some of the means the Roundtable and its allies employed to achieve these victories. What had happened to the Labor Law Reform Act? There are a couple of peculiar American handicaps to union organizing. Management can delay indefinitely representation elections, and whenever management calls a meeting to argue against union organization, it can prevent access to unions at these meetings, in fact, preventing unions from stating their case. The proposed Labor Law Reform Act was to secure some limited reduction in these handicaps. The Business Roundtable joined the NAM, the Chamber of Commerce, and others in a National Action Committee to wage all-out war against the bill. While its associates flooded Congress with stimulated mail, running to millions of letters and postcards, attacking the power and legitimacy of organized labor, the NAM kept a relatively low profile. It hired a public relations firm to manage its enormous grassroots efforts, which, in an update of the Mohawk Valley formula, were directed to stimulating public sentiment hostile to unions. To this end, opinion surveys were used for publicity as quickly as the pollsters could produce the right result, and 329 pages of editorials opposing labor law reforms were prepared and distributed to local newspapers countrywide. In December 1977, as though to signal an all-out war on labor, the president of the NAM announced the formation of the Council on a Union-Free Environment, which would, he said, be the first single-purpose national organization devoted to the maintenance of a union-free environment in the United States. A second victim to such lobbying became the Consumer Protection Bill. The Roundtable and its allies organized a national distribution of cartoons, pamphlets, ads, and newsletters in opposition to the Consumer Protection Agency, CPA. The Roundtable hired a public relations firm to distribute canned editorials and cartoons opposing the bill to 1,000 daily newspapers and 2,800 weeklies. Portions of the distributed material were published, without indication of source, approximately 2,000 times. The Roundtable also sponsored a fraudulent poll which claimed to show 81% of Americans opposed to the CPA, when independent polls showed them as 2-to-1 in favor. The Chamber of Commerce exploited the fraudulent poll in full-page ads in the New York Times and elsewhere. The defeat of the bill for a consumer protection agency was, Fortune reported, in 1980, a signal victory for the Round Table and, in retrospect, a watershed in the history of consumerism. A review of the Round Table's history in the nation sums up its achievements.
After a decade of defeat for the trade union movement, segments of a divided and weakened labor movement are now negotiating with key Round Table figures for a separate peace. With this final twist, the New Deal comes full circle. In the late 1970s, as in the late 1920s, the business of America is business, and the populace cannot imagine it otherwise.
As in 1919, 1921, and 1946 to 1950, so in 1976 to 1980, complete business hegemony over American society was reestablished. On each occasion, the same propaganda and public relations methods, if increasingly sophisticated, have accomplished the same result.
That was the second half of a one-hour program on corporations and propaganda by the late Alex Carey, an Australian sociologist and psychologist. The principal reader was Ed Markman. The music is by Chaz Smith. Richard Friedman read the text quotes. Sound clips are from the audio collection of San Francisco State University. The original program was produced in 1988 with help from the staff at KPFA Radio in Berkeley by me, Mariah Gilardin. A collection of essays by Alex Carey with a foreword by Noam Chomsky has since been published posthumously under the title Taking the Risk Out of Democracy. This program received the largest listener response of the year when it was first aired during a KPFA fundraiser. In preparing it for this broadcast, I was moved by the importance of the historic facts and Carey's analytical ideas. I decided to present it again at this time because it answers so many questions about the media, democracy, and corporate power. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Mariah Gilardin. Thank you for listening.